session number 30304.
Tedrena Reel 14.
The pilot and the navigator, the navigator being the, shall we say, extra pilot, would do the job alternately, which was the best way to learn, really. Particularly as most of the crew members, the pilots that I met at Thornaby were experienced, sensible, thank goodness, and very pleasant people. And that kind of tuition has much to be commended. Whether we would have done as well if we'd just sort of gone off to a navigation school and been happy to have a chap doing all the navigation, I doubt very much. So we had then, I think I'm perhaps meandering a little, but I'm coming back to the fact that we were interested in what we did when we first went to the squadron. So we had to meet and learn how to work with the other two members who were, again, adaptable and worked alternately between being a wireless operator and an air gunner. That situation came into being when the other air crew were awarded the ranks of sergeants, because in the early days of the war, and in the peacetime RAF, ground crew who volunteered to fly would get a little extra pay, and they would go up perhaps to the rank of a leading aircraftman. But we, when I started, we were all sergeants, and I think that was a good thing, all to be of the same rank. It didn't, but then when I got more experience and I became a captain, then I would have a new crew, a new pilot from OTU. But of course, the usually the wireless operator and air gunner would stay with the crew, so we got on quite well together and knew what we were each doing.
Were you allocated your wireless operator air gunners, or was there a method of crewing up where you...
No, they were allocated. I don't know of anyone who wasn't happy with the crew members allocated to them. There didn't seem to be much to dislike about any of the chaps that I came across.
Was the same keenness there for people? Because obviously, until that stage, you'd really mixed with just pilots under training, hadn't you? But was the same keenness amongst other aircrew who were doing different roles?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, some of them thought they really ought to be, at least be considered, as captains. Because this is when we were down at Sandero, actually, we had quite a discussion, which is a good thing, about Chris Lewis. Chris Lewis was my wireless op. I say my wireless op, but it's strange how, although they were, well, the usual thing was that they would alternate, so that Chris would be the wireless operator and Harold Hamer, a lad from Bolton, actually, and he was lost, unfortunately, when Henry was shot down. But they were a good pair, and they swapped. But they seem to prefer, begin to prefer the one job compared with the other, and they're quite happy to sort of, I would regard, if I had to say now who was your crew, I would say Rayner, Holland, Lewis and Hamer. Not Lewis or Hamer, or Hamer or Lewis, it would be like that. So it was a matter of getting the camaraderie together and learning what to do for the circumstances appropriate to the particular airfield. I don't think any of the other Hudson squadrons down the East Coast had some of the problems we had at Thornaby. And because, of course, it was a heavily industrialised area, they were all on war work. We had balloons within a very short distance of the airfield, and they talk about CO2 emissions, and they, more often than not, there was a sort of haze, particularly over the place to the north, I just forget the name of it. Billingham, ICI Works. And so when the pilot I was flying with said, "Well, I'll show you how to get in bad weather," said, because this sort of smog didn't very often last out to sea. You may have come across the North Sea in quite open weather, and then you could see the sort of smog in the distance. And he said, "Well, you aim for Red Car Pier." And so the piers kept peering into the future. then take the A174. I think I'm right in 174, along the below the Cleveland Hills, and one or two other things to look out for. And then you look out for the Coronation Pub, and there's a crossroad, there's a fork there. You take the left fork until you come to you can see the river. And then you see the aerodrome down on your right, but don't go much past that point, or you'll be having an argument with the balloons. This was his joke, I remember it well. Unless your name is Weaver, you're bound to become a cropper. So in that way, we learned the secrets of getting, and it was still me in good stead much later. It was a matter of getting used to watching your instruments, because the important thing, of course, if you can get down to identify places on your route, then you're not very far off ground level. So you've got to keep an eye on your flying position and altitude.
Could you have problems there, obviously, in that kind of coastal position you were in, of kind of sea folks coming in, that type of things?
Yes. But those are usual, aren't they? I was thinking of just this particular trouble at Thornaby, which I don't think was... I mean, you can't imagine that up at Wick, can you? Not that same kind of smog, anyway.
You've mentioned, obviously, the role that at that time while you were training of what yourself and the second pilot would do. Can you tell me what the wireless operator's role is on board the aircraft?
What they were doing. They were listening out most of the time. There wasn't anything like the traffic then, of course. Air traffic, wireless traffic, that became the case later. And of course, it was that wonderful time when we were flying independently. The task would be an independent task, other than when we flew a battle flight or something like that. And we didn't have RT, we had intercommunication within the aircraft, but it was seldom used. I mean, I remember flying without a, and my pilot would be, or I would be navigating it, and alternatively, flying and he would be navigating, and we would pass instructions verbally. And if the wireless operator was in a Hudson, relatively near, just behind on the right, not behind the second pilot, if you like, he would yell, something coming through, and so he'd listen, to write it down, pass it to us. That was general, but of course there were occasions when we had to put up with the inconvenience of wearing a helmet, just simply to have the opportunity to hear things firsthand, or I don't know where we got them from, but one or two of us got just simply headphones without the helmet. And the wireless operator's job, as far as we were concerned at that time, was to be on the qui vive. And that, of course, is also a pun in a way, they were using the word qui. He had to be ready to tap out any messages on the instruction of either the pilot or the navigator. The rear gunner would, well, I don't know how some of them kept awake, really. You'd hit sometimes, of course, when you left on a job, you cocked the, because the gun, the front guns in the Hudson were fired by the pilot. You would test your guns, and you would hear the rat-a-tat-tat of the rear gunner checking his. And if he was feeling very full of it one morning, he might well have a second go when we're in the middle of the North Sea, or see something worth having a bit of a practice at.
With the rear guns, is there something that prevents them shooting parts of the aircraft? I'm thinking of the tail. Is there a mechanism that, yes, that's employed to do that?
Yes. I don't know what it is, but thank goodness it works. Yes. It's amazing how far round that turret in Hudson could be swung so that the rear gunner could fire forward. Well, I would think probably up to an angle of about 30 or 40 degrees off a northerly off a zero heading. In fact, when we attacked the Conda, the German four-engine FW, the chap who was in the rear turret that day, was quite a forceful sort of chap. He said, I've been firing at it with the front guns without apparently much effect, although we did see the smoke coming out of the rear of the Condor, and he said, it's my turn, and he swung his turret round, and so I had to sort of crab up to it, pull the nose round to the left so he could get a firing line on it. But generally, we occasionally had the luxury of, when it was a very quiet patrol and the wireless operator, and I don't know whether they had some kind of communication, secret communication with the home station. But when they thought there was a quiet time on the airwaves, they would, some of them were more successful than others, but they could retune the set so that we would have some music, like Harry Roy and Lou Stone, Who's Taking You Home Tonight, and all that sort of thing, which was very enjoyable.
So, initially, these training missions, what would you actually do in them? Would you, I mean, obviously, it's to get, you mentioned it's to get the crew to gel together and work as a team, but what kind of form would they take, the first type of missions that you would fly in a kind of training capacity?
Well, we were supposed to be trained, you see. By the time we reached the squadron, we were supposed to be trained. We were still learning. So it would be an operational flight. We didn't have any training flights as such. It would be on the flight on the squadron notice board, the crew board. What was the name of my first pilot then? P.O. was Aqua, something like that, and crew. SA3 departure 0800 hours. You go to ops room and just pick up the usual. Either there was something there or there wasn't.
What do you mean by the usual there, though, Ted? What would you pick up? Because obviously, if you can take me through a kind of a basic kind of patrol that you would do, and really from the start to finish of how that would work,
yes.
as in the position, say, of second pilot, as when you were first starting out there, what would your role be? How would it work? Right. What time would you arrive? What would you do?
Yes, all right, we're going to take off with our 800 hours then, go on an SA3 patrol. We would report to the control room at about 0700, and draw parachutes, and as I'm in this case, you've mentioned the second pilot, I would consult the navigating officer about the possible diversions, or he would tell me of any known, together with the briefing officer, any known enemy activity likely to come within that patrol. And then after the briefing, and we wouldn't be at that point joined yet with the wireless operator and the air gunner, because the wireless operator and the air gunner, because after all he was a sort of second wireless operator if anything happened to the first one, would have their separate briefing from the chief wireless operator. I can't think of his actual designation. So then we'd probably meet going out to the aircraft, get towards the aircraft for an 0800 takeoff at about 20 to 8, and do the usual check externally, particularly having a look at the pitot head cover, which must be removed, looking to see that the controls were working properly. Even the tires, of course, are pumped up. And then to go in the aircraft do the internal checks, eventually to start up the engines, for which we would need assistance from a battery-operated starter, for want of a better word. And once the engines were started, to let them warm up a little and then go through the likely use of the engine from low power up to as near as full power as possible against the brake and the chocks. Do that individually, I mean, one engine after the other, and set the compass course and the altimeter in particular. I mean, set the compass course on the compass, the one that we had to fly once we were in the air. And check various dials and switches to make sure, for instance, that the automatic pilot was working all right. And it wasn't as though we couldn't fly the aircraft without the automatic pilot for any length of time. But if anything went wrong with it, it could interfere with the normal control of the aircraft. And so by 5 to 8 we were ready to taxi out onto the apron and take up a position at right angles to the runway we were using. And we would know which runway, we would have been told which runway we were using, but we could also see it indicated on the sign, the sign area, the area in front of the control tower, where various signs, can't think of a better word, though there is one, would be displayed. And then we would get the green light flashed from the tower, and we could turn onto the runway, have a good look around, see if there were no other aircraft likely to interfere, or we with them, and take off. As soon as we'd taken off, up with the undercarriage, and throttle back the engines to best climbing, revs and boost. There were 4 dials you particularly noticed at this time. 2 on the left were revs. The cruising, I think climbing was 2,000 revs. And I forget, 15 inches of boost, something like that. Anyway, we climb up to whatever height would be appropriate. Just to, if it was an SA3, which I suggested, then there's no need to go any higher than 2,000 feet, or even lower, of course, if there was cloud. Because if things remained normal, we would go down to 50 feet above the sea for the rest of the journey once we'd reached about halfway to try to get under German radar. Knowledge about German radar wasn't very readily available. I don't know how accurate it was, but it was generally felt, generally known, that it was a good idea to get down to 50 feet because they did have some form of radar able to monitor the approach of aircraft or ships up to enemy shores. If there was nothing to be seen, and of course we had many eyes watching, that was the whole purpose of the flight. When I've made these colourless suggestions about what the wireless operator did, or the gunner, which may have sounded a dereliction of duty, this was in the light of periods or on the way back, or close to the English coast, not when we needed our eyes peeled for our own safety. If we didn't see anything and there had been nothing brought to our attention, it was possible that we would have had some communication through the wireless operator that there was something here or something there which we ought to have a look at. But otherwise we would turn on to the leg at right angles for about no more than a quarter of an hour or something like that, and then on to the reciprocal leg to start the way back again. If we'd seen something if we'd seen something that needed investigation, then obviously it was our job to go and have a look. As when we found what apparently was a German iron ore convoy going down the Danish coast. No, that's wrong. That's not right, because we would have seen it before we got to the turn-off point. I'm sorry, I've assumed that we got to the turn-off point, haven't I? And then, so we better move the convoy a bit further out, I think, so we can pick him up on the homeward leg. Well, if that happened, we would tidy things up a bit, and quickly at that. We'd all be on the alert, and if there was any cloud cover, it is possible, with a bit of experience, to go into a cloud and do a turn, quite a wide turn in a cloud, and come out more or less where you wanted to, at least in a different position to that last seen by the enemy. So let's imagine we did that on this occasion. We went up, and this is what happened to this when we saw this iron ore. Well, we assumed it was an iron ore convoy because it had quite a bevy of other ships and a lot of flagships round it. And the Germans were bringing iron ore, very high grade iron ore, down from Norway to, well, obviously for use in their war munitions. So we'd go into cloud if it was 1,000 feet or something like that. If it was higher than that, it was probably too risky to try to get up into it, because remember we were 50 feet without presenting too much of a target to German gunners. If it was 1,000 feet, you could get up there fairly quickly, and particularly if you didn't put it in the negative, it didn't fly in a straight line. So we get up into the cloud and then make a turn in cloud, which we hope, because you've got it in your mind's eye just about where you want to come out, and then just drop, as it were, out of the cloud at the appointed point. And of course If we were close to the land, you'd make sure that this turn was away from the land and not towards it. Unfortunately, on this particular occasion, we were not far off course being appropriate for getting down on the deck and then going in to attack this major, the largest boat in the convoy. It's all over very shortly.